We are going to have about 15 minutes here. When we put the symposium together, we didn't want it to be all scientific information and stories from the scientists, but we wanted you to get involved too, because a lot of the symposium is about how do we take action. And so we have, in case you've forgotten, Howie Garrett. Thank you, Howie. We've got Scott Mercer Tree. Are you joining us? Okay. We have Michael Stalker, Doug Forsell. Jeff, are you in the audience? Jeff, you come on down. We've got Jeff coming down. He'll be on the panel later this afternoon. Jeff Jacobson, who is one of our great orca specialists up in Humboldt. And do we have Tristan? Is Tristan here? Well, when Tristan comes in, we'll get to meet her. She's going to be talking to us about subtidal environments this afternoon. She'll be one of the presenters. So if you guys see Tristan, you send her on over to the panel, okay? Yeah, let's have all the lights on so we can see everybody. So here's our panel, and I would like to start by asking a question and then seeing what questions we have from the audience. But I'd like to hear from each one of you, how do you not get paralyzed when you hear all this bad news? And then what gives you the motivation to take action? So if we could hear from you guys. Oh, I guess I should take the mic off. Oh, you have a mic.
I like to take a deep breath, and I look for solutions. I look for, you know, I don't try to weigh the, you know, probabilities, because nobody really knows, you know. All there is now. So let's look at what is possible, what could be done, what would be a solution, if only we would smarten up and try to, you know, suggest that in any way possible, and not worry about, you know, the overall picture. So, I mean, you know, be aware, but not fretting all the time about what it looks like it's becoming, because it's now still.
Well, I always hope that every little bit that everybody does contributes to our knowledge and may affect some policymakers somewhere along the line. So it's a matter, I get very depressed sometimes, but it's a matter of not really giving up and just keep working away, collecting data and trying to find out little bits of information. You never know what little bit might make a difference somewhere along the line. I was trying to think of, there have been some small findings here and there that have made a difference. Can't think of one at the moment here, but there are small little findings here and there, like the finding that, like the one circle graph that Howard showed of what they mostly feed on, and then those small slivers of other species of salmon that they do feed on, gives you an idea of the importance of breaching the dams, so that there's a free flow of water. I mean, it's documented now that that's what does the work. It's not just a matter of taking down dams. It is actually important to these, to 7 or 8 species of salmon.
Thanks. Yeah, that is really a challenge. We as conservation scientists are always looking under the hood, and we're seeing these systematic problems. We're seeing lots of kind of a homeostasis is kind of falling apart. And, you know, when I was a kid, my mom used to stick me, you know, next to a stream bed, and I'd be gone for the rest of the afternoon because there's so many little critters in it you could look at. And this is really not the case so much more. So there's systematic depression that's happening with a lot of us scientists, and it's starting to be addressed by people. But I saw a quote the other day which was to the effect of, you know, we can do the studies, we can look at mitigations, we can come up with various types of management plans, but the real problem is kind of rampant greed, and that's a spiritual issue that we don't really have the tools to address as scientists.
I don't think I got the chance to explain it, but one of the pictures I had was when I first went to Jarvis Island in 1977, and got off the boat and started looking around. There was a picture of a whole bunch of dead birds. There was essentially a dead bird every square meter. There were 200 cats on one square mile island and a couple million birds, and each cat was eating three or four birds a day of sooty terns or bigger ones. Essentially, I saw that and I was just appalled. And as I, over the years, it took us 8 years for the Fish and Wildlife Service to get it together and get rid of them. I used to call them every year and say, what are you doing about this? And I finally, to get rid of the cats on Howland Island, I volunteered, took 6 weeks of annual leave to go down and shoot those. Essentially, it comes down to a lot of times people aren't going to get it done unless you go do it yourself.
Yeah, good point. Haven't you noticed that most conservation efforts, when it comes down to saving a river or whatever, comes down to one person. Often one or two people are out there really pushing the work forward. What's easier to change, human tradition or the breeding cycle of a fish? One could wonder, and we've got lots of examples in the presentations today and that are all around now of how it can work. You know, the Navy used to do nuclear testing, on and on and on and on. Well, we have changed. Our ways are changing. That has its own pace. So how can we as individuals accelerate that pace by focusing the rest of the population on stuff that does work, on solutions that are out there, and still maintain our optimism? We have no choice. You know, so the optimism is the way forward. Otherwise, you get dragged down into that other abysmal pit. And just keep saying Tice's quote every day, and off you go.
Yeah, thank you. That reminds me of that Margaret Mead quote that I think we all know really well, but I want to just say it right now. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. In fact, it's the only thing that ever has. And that's what you're saying. You know, that one person changed the river. These are things that we have to keep telling ourselves, remembering, and find our allies and our local community to do that work. All right, so thank you very much. Let's take some questions from the audience now. Yeah, we've got beautiful Howie Garrett here from Whidbey Island. We have our local resident. Sounds like a local resident whale. Anyway, Scott Mercer, Michael Stalker, who's from Marin, Doug Forsell, and Jeff Jacobson from Humboldt, but really up and down the West Coast and as far as you can see. Okay, questions. Kira, you had one. Wondering about the common myrrh die-off that happened recently here on the coast. Where hundreds and hundreds were counted.
So May 15, there's a big storm hit here, really hard, really cold. The director of the NOAA weather station in Eureka said it was record-breaking for the amount of waves, the amount of wind, and how cold it was. A bunch of birds started washing up, and that was like unusual and et cetera. Common MERS, they were all flying south. When we were out there doing our boat surveys, we collected a bunch of MERS out there floating around, and they seemed to have been starving, no food. June 10, around that time, there were three or four very, very hot days. And Dan Barton, who does seabird surveys all up and down the coast, is a professor at Humboldt State. He was watching a colony of MERS that just started leaving the rock. And getting into the water and just floating around, and ravens were coming in and picking up eggs. So there were a lot of eggs there. The BLM drone flies over, he looks at the pictures and finally understands that the birds were so heat stressed that they're not tropical birds, they can't thermoregulate in hot climate like, so they abandoned, and there's piles of blue eggs on top of green rock off of Trinidad. And so it seemed to be a double punch that that's how we didn't see any chicks. I saw two chicks up just north here near Bear River, whatever, and seabird surveys that were active all up and down the coast for Marble Murrelets, they found none in Northern California, only a few in Oregon. So whether it was from the weather impacting and washing birds off of rocks and hitting them hard so they were so stressed they couldn't forage effectively in order to breed, and then the other heat lamp, the thermal stress had them abandon piles of eggs.
A lot of seabirds go through these boom and bust things, so many, and then they're also exacerbated by human activity. So like the Bering Sea right now there's a lot of stuff going around about, they're estimating millions of birds are dying, these shearwaters and stuff that move back and forth because of the warm water up there. It happens a lot. It happens a lot with individual birds. If you think about a bird that lives 50 or 60 years, or even smaller ones like cormorants that may, on the East Coast, they were essentially figured that double-crested cormorants were gonna go extinct, but they have 5 young. So in order to maintain a population, and they live 20 years, or up to 20 years, essentially to replace yourself in a population, you only need to get 1 young through a 10-year period or something. So there's lots of birds like in the Bering Sea, the kittiwakes, that can fail year after year after year, but then they get a good year and you get a couple young off, and you know, you can replace yourself if you don't have too many other things. So there are a lot of boom and busts of birds. El Niños in the South Pacific, you can go to those islands and you know, you'll have tens of thousands of birds, but they'll be young sitting around that have no food, and they eventually just starve. And so boom and bust is a common thing among birds. Just when they're wash up on our shores, we tend to notice it a lot more. But there's a lot more of these warming events.
So the adaptation that nature can make is good, it's fluid. And with these extra pressures coming down from human impact, that might be waning. That ability to survive and replace and reproduce with all the pressures that the ocean is under. Yeah.
Yeah, so hopefully we're able to somewhat mitigate by doing these things, getting rid of fisheries that are killing birds or habitat problems, and getting rid of predators, that we can make the species more resilient to those effects.
Yeah. So how can we get kelp back?
And we don't really have a kelp person up here, but it is a problem. When I was a kid, the Japanese factory kelp harvesters were off the boat here. They thought it was a good idea because the fish were hiding in the kelp. And so the fishermen thought, well, if you get rid of the kelp, the fish will be easy to get, right? So it's not a systematic thing. That was pretty severe, and I think that set this kind of oscillation of, because what happened when that occurred, the otters just started disappearing, the sea urchins came out. I mean, just would start these oscillations of various types of systematic intersections. And, you know, what's happening now, we had that starfish wasting disease that happened a couple of years ago. I mean, we have these oscillations, which a lot of them are probably significantly exacerbated by human agency, the stresses that we put on the system. What's happened with the kelp specifically right now, it's not really my specialty, but my suspicions are, to answer your questions, in terms of kelp permaculture, I mean, I think it's a good idea. It's one way that we might be able to help kind of cushion the system a little bit. It remains to be seen what other kind of ancillary impacts that has, whether they're good or bad, and just hope for the best.
And we'll have Sheila Siemens here on our panel, bringing it home this afternoon, and we know that she's got a lot more information on urchin barrens and kelp and how that those two tie together. So, yeah.
There's been talk about wind turbines off Fort Bragg and also
Put your hands up.
So the take on wind turbines up and down the coast.
I spent about 10 years working on the turbines from the offshore stuff that we were doing, and then each study that was done for proposed turbines up and down the East Coast, I would either advise on them or help them design their bird surveys that they needed to do. That's a whole hour talk about effects. I mentioned one is just one that they don't think about is putting them near oil or near channels. But there's lots of other effects, possibly the birds getting hit. The advantage is that as they get bigger and bigger, most of the birds are flying lower. And as they get taller to where the bottom of the turbine is 200 or 300 feet up in the air, you're less chance of getting the birds. But there's sound, there's vibrations, there's, which we heard about last night, there's electronic transmission lines that set up electrical fields in the water. There's the possible effects are enormous, but some of the beneficial effects of reducing our carbon input may help outweigh that, you know.
Accentuate that a little bit. So we do know that fossil fuel is killing the planet. That's that simple. And we're going to have to look at a balance of harms. It is a work in progress right now in terms of understanding the impacts on birds and understanding the impacts of the sound on the animals inside the electromagnetic fields that are perhaps disrupting the migrations of elasmobranchs. There's a lot of possibilities here, but we know that fossil fuel is killing us. But one of the things I'd like to reframe this power usage thing for all of us is that we tend to think that a solution will be to unplug everything from fossil fuel and plug it into sustainable. We actually have to look at using less energy.
Right. So, great. Oh, yeah, you want to answer that, Scott? So we have time for one more question. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I have a follow-up for Howard's presentation. And that really introduced him to the politics of the Snake River Dams. I know the Army Corps is, you know, their goal is all about flood control. And if they're the ones that are managing those dams, is that still what's being, the story that's still being sold is these are needed for flood control?
For power generation, is that what you said? Oh, floods? No, flood control. That is what you might term technically a lie. They are not for flood control. They were designed specifically as what are called run-of-the-river dams. That is one of the rationales that is, you know, sent out there all the time for keeping the dams, flood control. No, they can only operate with some flow constantly. So if they can't store water and function in any other way, so they are made to continually be circulating the water, they are not storage. So they are designed not to be flood control. That, yeah, it's used, but nope, not true.
Okay, I have to get this gentleman here. I kept skipping you, I'm sorry.
We've taken looks at various camera angles on various, what I would call symptoms almost.
A spiritual renewal. I think we need to reassess our whole relationship with nature, our whole sense of family, of you know, co-survival, that we depend on everything, and we, you know, that the plant people, the animal people, they are all our family, and we need to adopt that kind of reverence and gratitude for all of the life that is around us that sustains us. I think it's a very deep feeling that has been obliterated by industrial society for hundreds of years, that we need to renew within ourselves, and I think then behavior will follow that will protect all that.
All right. Sorry, we don't have any. We don't have time for any more questions right now because we need to break for lunch. What? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, one more.
The State Department of Natural Resources has banned all non-native fish from being farmed. There is a proposal to farm sterilized trout, and that's in abeyance right now, so we'll see how far that goes, but at least that is being clamped down on. Oh, in Washington State, all of Puget Sound.
Anyway, we are going to break for lunch. We've got to get our presenters fed and fueled up for the rest of the afternoon. Please come back.